Hello, everyone, and welcome to another Scanline Status for August 9th, 2016. I am Colin Detmar of Scanline Media.
And I am Ben Unkle of Scanline Media.
And we're here to talk about the last week in video games for us and, you know, the world at large, I suppose. And I want to start by fulfilling a promise from last time, which was by the time we recorded this, I said I would have played 30 Flights of Loving. I did.
Nice. What'd you think of it?
I enjoyed it. I liked it. I don't know. I at once can and can't see why it was so hyped up. Like, it's out of sequence storytelling. It's in medias res. It's lack of dialogue, but conveying the story anyway. Its art style, all of those things were really strong, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, like, the gameplay is nothing special, which it didn't need to be, but...
Yeah, it's more like it's something to get you from A to B, so you can see the things that are happening on screen.
Yeah, and, like... I mean, like, the environments weren't, like, particularly, like, they weren't, like, bad. The environments weren't bad, but it's not like our traditional idea of a walking simulator, like a Gone Home or something, or Everybody's Gone to the Rapture, where the environment has a bunch of details, and that's why the gameplay isn't that complex, is because I hate to phrase it this way, but, like, the video game part of it is you poking at the world, right? And 30 Flights of Loving feels a lot more like you push the keys and move the mouse so the story happens. And that's not a problem, but it's something I felt a little conflicted about, I guess.
Yeah, I suppose I could see that since, in general, you seem to be less into, like, sitting down and watching a movie or things like that, and it's a lot more passive than games that you're used to, essentially.
But yeah, like I have trouble with overly passive media. It's just I don't know, it could be my you know, a problem with my brain, right? But like I have trouble sitting still for that stuff sometimes, and giving me minor ways to interact can sort of like keep that tension off, can keep me from feeling stifled, but there wasn't a whole lot to interact with, right? It's like, oh, a lot of the situations I could walk up and click on, like, bottles of vodka to instantly drink them. So it's like, oh, like, this scene is going on, and drink as many bottles of vodka as you can, just for laugh, while this scene is ongoing. But it's like, the fact that I could interact with the world mostly seemed irrelevant, so I wasn't sure why I could. At times, I didn't think that, right? Like, I guess I'm going to spoil 30 Flights of Loving, which is a game that's, like, 20 minutes long. Just play it. But, like, there's a part where you... So you are one of three members of a crew that attempted a heist of a sorts, and it has gone bad, and you are wheeling one of your cohorts, who is in a wheelchair, through an airport, right? And then a bunch of, like, I guess flying drones, like, spot you and attack you. And you start wheeling him around in the wheelchair as he busts out two guns and just starts popping at them, right? And you don't have much influence over that. You're just kind of driving around while he shoots. But that's really fun. That was one moment where I really liked the way it was handled, right?
Mm-hmm.
But, like, parts where... I don't know, like, at the wedding, right? Where you're at this wedding and, you know, like, there's a couple getting married and, like, eventually you have to take a seat and there's a toast and... But, like, until you take a seat and toast, it just felt really weird and stilted that I had control at all. Because there was nothing to do with it.
I kind of see what you're getting at, but I feel like sometimes just moving around within that world... Well, Blendo Games has this very specific style for most of their 3D games that, you basically walk around these worlds that are like a combination of sort of retro 50s, 60s aesthetic futuristic elements and lots of Naked Gun style humor. And I feel like just wandering around in that sort of environment and be like, oh, hey, while I'm walking up to this party, I can see all these weird cats doing things. That's just something that's very... It manages to tell a story that, while it's not 100% original or anything like that, it's one of those situations where just moving around within that area adds some levity to some of the more serious plot boilers sort of emotions that they're going for.
It seemed hit and miss to me. Like the wedding in particular was one spot where I felt like the environment didn't offer much entertainment, personally. And like, it's not, to me, it's not a Blendo Games thing, right? Because I did play some Quadrilateral Cowboy. I'm never going to say that right on the first try. I did play some of that, and I think the environments in that, like, especially like your sort of your home base, the environments in that are really cool to walk around. I did not have that problem at all in there. I was like, Blendo Games' vision, especially in Quadrilateral Cowboy, of how this, like, the weird state of technology and design in their world is just fascinating, right?
Yeah, like the when you're jetting around to an apartment of one of your friends, which is in this giant cylindrical dome surrounded by all these buses that are impaled by pikes and stacked on top of each other. Just really interesting sort of makeshift homes and ideas of what this future... You can't quite tell if it's something that it's... There's been some sort of accident that means everyone has to scrounge, or if it's just the way that this world kind of grew up within this alternate universe.
It feels like it must be the latter, because there are examples like in the very first mission, well, I guess technically the very second mission you do in Quadrilateral Cowboy, you are sent to photograph some records. And when you get to the thing, you don't pull out like a smartphone. You don't even pull out a camera. You pull out a device which you set on the paper, which unfolds into a stand with a camera on it that shoots automatically. And it's this really, like, elaborately built, pointlessly intricate machine that speaks to an entirely different history to me. You know? Like, in the world we have today, with the solutions we have for taking pictures of things, there's no reason that thing would ever exist.
The safe thing, too, is really cool, how basically you pull a lever and it brings out a randomly generated set of numbers that has to go through this tube and can't be broken by any of the lasers. And if it gets there, you just enter the numbers on there and that's your safe code.
Yeah, it's like a combination of the concept of like the one-time pad for encoding combined with like a bank teller's mnemonic tube. It's really like... There's a lot of really, like, fascinating, like, physicality to all the technology in that world, which I really enjoy. So, like, in Quadrilateral Cowboy, I feel like that environmental... I don't even want to say environmental storytelling, because a lot of the time it's not storytelling. It's just that environmental detail and attention really shines through. And in 30 Flights of Loving, I just felt at times it fell short, and I didn't... Yeah, I didn't know why I had control, because there didn't seem to be much point to me.
That's fair. Even compared to Gravity Bone, which Gravity Bone is also telling its own sort of story, except it's much more focused in kind of putting you in this role of a spy for at least a bit before it kind of pulls the rug out of your from under your feet. But yeah, overall, both Quadrilateral Cowboy and Gravity Bone have you doing things like taking pictures of exploding pigeons.
So, I didn't play Gravity Bone, even though it's included in 30 Flights of Loving. Maybe I'll promise to play that by next time. I don't know. I'll think about it. What have you been playing?
Well, I did try and go back to complete more Quadrilateral Cowboy recently, but one, I found out that somehow it had... Well, I recently rebuilt my PC, which took up a bit of time. But when I got it back, I realized they didn't have any sort of cloud saves, but also it has that thing where they must have realized that that would be a situation for some people because the saves in that game have been kind of broken by a bunch of bugs. So there's an option. If you just go to continue career, you can pretty much choose any missions you want to, backwards or forwards. So I ended up starting that again with where I had left off. And I just come to this set of puzzles that I'm just not wrapping my mind around. And not only that, when I tried to kind of poke at it, it started crashing again. And it's like, this game's been out for weeks, and the thing that I'm trying to do wasn't even very complicated. I just put down my gun case, and it accidentally fell off a ledge, and when I picked it back up, the game just crashed. It's just, it's really unstable in a way that makes it very unfun to experiment with sometimes, and it's a shame because experimentation is that game.
The gameplay of Quadrilateral Cowboy seems neat. It really just didn't click with me, and I'll probably give it another shot, but I wasn't having a very good time with it. But it is, like, what they're doing with that game does, like, it is made by a single guy with, Brendan Chung, with, I think, some help from contractors, right? But, like, pretty much just him, really. And so, like, I imagine it's going to take him a while to fix those issues because it's, yeah, just him working on those. And it's a game that really heavily uses Doom 3's in-world computer technology. Like, in Doom 3, it was used for occasionally clicking a button and at one point playing an emulated version of the original Doom. In Quadrilateral Cowboy, it's used to run a fake hacking OS that affects the real world, and I can imagine that that would be a nightmare from a code standpoint.
Yeah. Basically one command prompt affecting things on another command prompt.
Yeah, I don't know shit about programming, but that this is taking a while to fix does not it's very disappointing, but at the same time, I guess I kind of understand, because it's like, oh yeah, God, that would be a nightmare.
Yeah. It's definitely an incredibly ambitious game. He created his own Steam guide for in-depth explanations on how to create your own mods for it. How to use the map level editing tools for Doom and everything like that. And he's put out a lot of legwork for all of that stuff. So I really admire the dedication and everything. It just, after a certain point, you can only deal with so many crashes before you just put it aside for a while and go to other more stable things. Do you have anything else to... And
no, I mean, I didn't play that much of it, so I don't think I have that much to add to Quad Cow.
Okay.
So you kind of, but in before we started recording this, you kind of teased something about a Telltale Facebook post.
Yeah. So I just found out that earlier today they basically posted a Telltale on their Facebook page posted a 30-second spot from eCorp talking about a new social messaging app coming August 17th. Except if you keep up with TV at all, which I know you're not big into American TV, Colin.
Not so much.
But yeah, if you watch the 30-second teaser, you can basically tell they're talking about eCorp and... At the very end of that, the stinger is them quickly changing it to Evil Corp, which means that undoubtedly they're doing something with Mr. Robot, because Evil Corp is what he's basically, the main character of Mr. Robot, Elliot, he basically brain hacked himself, or whatever it's called, to condition yourself to always see E Corp as Evil Corp, and...
That sounds like the stupidest thing.
He's not the smartest person sometimes, no.
I It's one of those situations where it's like, okay, just because a writer wrote a thing which is dumb, maybe there's something, maybe it's a smart thing for that, but it's hard for me not to hear that and just go, wow, that show must be the dumbest.
It's kind of a cute thing, because pretty much everything within the show itself, all the characters and everything, refer to it as Evil Corp, because this dude is basically so obsessive that he does weird things to himself, like he... His method of not being addicted to morphine is smashing up a few morphine pills and snorting them. And he thinks that the amount that he snorts makes him free of addiction, but a few episodes in, and nope, not so much, dude. But yeah, that whole series is this really amazingly... Well, some of the elements of the story would probably be pretty cringeworthy to some people, and at the very beginning of that show, it is kind of a bit heavy-handed, but as it goes on, it becomes this really cerebral sort of thing where people are breaking into and out of systems in the slickest ways possible, except when things go wrong, and there's this really intriguing idea of espionage and trying to essentially climb your way up this corporate ladder in the most brutal way possible. And just this combination of all these different ideas that would work really, really well for a Telltale game, or any narrative game, really, because it's all about basically trying to... Basically, all of the characters in their... in that show, in their own way, are trying to get theirs, whether that's the destruction of modern society as we know it, or basically being at the top of the food chain. Hmm. They're all kind of striving for their own weird goals, and as it progresses and you get to know the characters more, you can really start to understand why they might want to do these things, and it's a really fascinating show. And really beautifully shot, too.
Yeah, I don't know. My hang-ups are my hang-ups, but I can't remember the last Western live-action show that I've really enjoyed. It's been a long time. So, I don't know. The way Western television development and writing has gone just does not speak to me at all. But that's fine. Doesn't need to.
Fair.
Hmm. Okay. Well, so I went back to Fire Emblem Fates this week for a little bit. Not very long at all, because I don't know if I'm ever coming back again. I think I'm done with that game, and it's weird. I'm a pretty big Fire Emblem fan. I own every Fire Emblem game that has been released in the U.S., including that Wii one, which was a bitch to track down. And I have disliked a couple of them, right? I disliked Shadow Dragon on DS because it was a remake of the first one, and it was a overly loyal remake of an old NES game whose design is out of date, in my opinion. I kind of disliked the Wii one Radiant Dawn just because, holy shit, that game was hard. Like, easiest difficulty... I'm an experienced Fire Emblem player. Easiest difficulty, I played the first mission, and I lost the first three times.
Jeez.
It's really, really hard. And, there's a lot of cool stuff in it, but it's just making any progress is such a brutal grind. And Fates is an interesting thing because there's three campaigns, right?
Yeah, which one were you basically working through?
I have been playing through both of the primary ones, and then there's sort of the third one, which is like a, you know, best of both worlds kind of thing, which I was planning to save for when I beat the other two, right? Because that's sort of recommended how it goes. It's like there's side with the Hoshidans, side with the Norians, and then sort of refuse to choose a side, which is like the third bonus playthrough, basically. They're sort of going for a Pokemon Red and Blue thing, only there's a lot... Like, the missions and stuff are unique. The storyline is kind of unique, though you see characters recur.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is the writing, and the well, it's mostly the writing. There's also some problems with, like, side missions. I'll get the little minor problems out of the way. The side missions that pop up, you can play at any time, but they auto-scale to your level. And some of the auto-scaling is really bad. Like, there's one that I should have done early, and I put off, and now is just impossible, because it's full of, like, enemies who can fly, so they can cover about, you know, like, they can control, like, 75% of the map at once, just be anywhere they want to, and they can one-shot anyone who isn't a tank.
What?
And it's just like, okay, I can't play this without losing people. It's just not doable.
And now you have all these really high-level people that you don't want to lose at all.
Right, and also they're high-level because of that. Like, if I'd done this earlier, then my healers could have survived it, but, like, I cannot protect my healers from them. I cannot. They will get hit. There is no positioning where they don't. So it's just like, I don't know, do I want to turn off permadeath? I could do that, but I've lived with permadeath for every other Fire Emblem game, and I feel like it'd be lame to have to turn it off just because of this one badly scaled side mission. As frustrating.
Yeah.
And that's, yeah.
I'm impressed that you play those games on permadeath, that sort of, those sorts of situations, anything like that, XCOM in particular for me, just puts me into such a cascading ball of stress that I end up quitting out.
I am okay with having to replay a mission if I want to get the optimal outcome, and there have been not very many, like most playthroughs, I don't let anyone die, sometimes one person, right?
Mm-hmm.
But there are times where it's like, okay, that's, with my level of understanding of this game and strategy, the best I can do is only losing one person who I didn't like very much. And I'm going to have to live with that. And I think that's kind of interesting, you know? It's like, huh. Like, in Sacred Stones, which is my favorite of the Fire Emblems, maybe. Mm-hmm. Awakening was really good. But, like, the Light Mage, Artur, the mission where you get him, I played it through it, I think, maybe 6 times. And the 6th time I got a clear with everyone surviving except for Artur. And I was just like, okay, that's the best I'm going to do. which is kind of satisfying in its own way. It's just like, no, like sometimes you lose people. And if you're pushing yourself, that's good. As long as it's not too frustrating. But the real problem with the game is that Fire Emblem has always been pretty formulaic in its storytelling. It's always been the plucky protagonists versus the evil empire. Every time. There have been little variants on it, like in the GameCube one, you're not playing, like, for once you're not playing a prince or a princess, you're playing just like a commoner who's in charge of a mercenary band, right? Like, oh my god, he's not nobility. What a dramatic change in the story.
Was that their excuse for making it so hard?
That was the Wii one, which was the sequel to the GameCube one. But no, the GameCube one wasn't that hard, actually. I mean, it was a little tough, but it wasn't too bad. But in this one, the sort of the two campaigns means you play both sides, depending on what campaign you're playing. So on one side, you're playing the good guys, and on one side, you're playing the evil empire. And on a gameplay sense, they do an interesting thing, which is that the good guys campaign is more like modern Fire Emblem. You have the ability to grind for levels if you want to by doing bonus missions anytime you want. And the missions themselves are less punishing. Usually your objectives are pretty simple, right? Just like, no, clear all the enemies out.
Yeah.
And on the on Conquest, the Norian campaign, you cannot grind for levels. The only missions you can do are the, like, the set side missions that come up and the story missions as they come up. And your objectives are often more complicated. Like, it's like, oh no, you've got to, like, you just have to hold out, or you have to escape, or you have to kill these enemies and stop them from continuously respawning, or you have to protect these 3 villages from getting burned down. And they're way harder. It's more like classic older Fire Emblem. And that's really enjoyable from a gameplay standpoint. It pushes you pretty hard, but not as hard as the Wii one. It's tough. It's certain maybe the second or third toughest Fire Emblem game I've ever played, but it's satisfying. But the story is so atrociously bad on that side. Like, they have not... You're still playing the really nice, like, optimistic, energetic, youthful character, but you're fighting for this evil empire, and the logic of the entire game breaks down because, like, your quote-unquote father, who is the evil emperor, like, treats you like garbage and tries to kill you, straight up kill you over and over, and your character keeps being like, oh, I'm sorry, I must have messed something up. What else can I do for you? And it just, the logic of it makes no fucking sense. It's incoherent.
Wait, why would he continue to try and kill you if you're helping him so much?
That's a good fucking question, isn't it? If he's like, here, your punishment for insulting my beard is that I'm going to send you alone into enemy territory, in territory that we have no hopes of conquering, and then you single-handedly take over it. And he's like, how dare you? It's like, dude, I just fucking did you a solid. Like, if you're an evil emperor, you are the stupidest evil emperor because you can't even recognize a pawn who is willing to follow you as you repeatedly try to kill them. Like, it's just nonsense.
How about the other side, then?
The other side works because it's just Fire Emblem. The other side works because it's just a bunch of anime people talking about how friendship and love are great, and you'll never understand, you evil person, because you can't trust anyone, and love is best, and friends, and love. I mean, it's anime garbage. It works. It's anime garbage. But the other side just doesn't. And the problem is that before... Well, the problem is twofold. On my conquest campaign with the Norians, the evil empire, I am on a mission that's pretty hard, and I've given it a couple of stabs, and I would give it more, but this one's the hardest one I've gotten to yet, and I know that if I manage to beat it, I'm going to be rewarded with more garbage story that's incoherent, so that's not super motivating. And then on the other side, I'm stuck on that side mission that is terribly scaled, and also having like not finished that campaign, having switched over to play some Conquest while still doing that one, I'm kind of unsatisfied with how, like, straightforward and linear the missions are of just kill everyone you see. So it feels like from a production standpoint, from features, from graphics, from all this stuff, they absolutely had the resources to make two full games here, which is basically what they did, right? But their writing crew just didn't fucking try. And I want to say, like, the localization is not as good as Awakening's was, but the localizers for the English, like, they fucking worked their asses off, right? But localization only takes you so far. You can't create a new plot for the game.
Yeah.
So the story is garbage, and just, like, while the idea of, like, let's have the casual one and the more hardcore one makes sense, it makes it hard for someone who wants to play both, because one or the other is going to turn out to be up your alley, and then the other one is going to feel disappointing in comparison.
And you basically have to spend $80 to figure out which one, unless you get lucky the first time, right?
Yeah. And it's just, it's really, that game is my biggest disappointment of the year, and that's coming off of me calling Awakening one of the best games of the year it came out, and just being, you know, a rabid fan for that series, and I'm just so disappointed in that.
Yeah, that does sound like a shame. I still need to check out Awakening at some point. Well, I played a bit when I was over at your place, but I haven't played a ton of it or anything.
It's
like
so
that.
Good. It's so good. But speaking of disappointments, you saw Suicide Squad.
I don't think I could call it disappointed, yeah.
That's a fair point. It's expectation is the question there, right?
Yeah. I've made no bones about how little I care for DC's whole cinematic the term that they use is cinematic universe, which they also use for Marvel, but it basically means all these movies have the same tone and are in the same universe as one another. And, yeah, Man of Steel wasn't great. It was pretty terrible, and everything I had heard about Batman vs. Superman was also dire. And, I don't know, I kind of went into this sort of... My expectations weren't incredibly high, but I also was like, hey, this is made by David Ayer. This is the dude who did Training Day and stuff like that. He knows his way around an action movie, is what I'm basically saying. And it's clear that he had some control over it, but just a combination of the writing, the acting, and especially the editing, it is the most... is one of the messiest, most uncomfortable films I've ever seen.
I feel like, and I'll want to get more details in a minute here, but I feel like movie to movie, game to game, we can put the like a certain amount of blame for the tone and the writing on the people working on it, right?
Yeah.
Like, you can put a certain amount of how Man of Steel was grim, dark, and really stupid ways on Zack Snyder, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you could put a certain amount of some of the gross shit in Batman Arkham Knight on the shoulders of that studio, my brain.
Rocksteady?
Yes, Rocksteady, thank you. But when you look at the bigger picture, you have to notice that this is consistently happening, and a lot of it has to be coming from Warner.
Yeah, the impression that... Oh, I've seen this suggested at least in one other place, but I think it's a pretty good guess. I feel like after Dark Knight came out, which is a pretty great movie, but it pretty much inspired all of the Warner creative team projects to go a certain direction, and that direction is really, really hard to sell well. That's the thing that I feel like most of these creators don't realize. Like, you can get away with a certain amount of cheesy dialogue in the more happy stories, like Batman the Brave and the Bold is just like a giant bucket of cheese, but it's very, very enjoyable to watch because it's a lighthearted romp that does fun things with the character. And basically The Dark Knight basically paved the way for Batman Arkham Asylum series and the direction that took and all of those other projects. And it's kind of a shame because it feels like they've committed to... Let's see, they've plotted out movies until 2022 with DC. So unless they decide to pull the brakes and think of something new, they're kind of stuck down this road of misery.
And it's not like they're getting, like, I don't think those movies are, like, they're not shaking the world, right? But they're making enough money that it's worth DC's time to keep making them. So it's not even really like they're getting slapped on the wrist for their behavior. They don't care. Like, they could make more money, but they've got these plans laid out, and it's doing okay, just fucking keep doing it. Don't make changes.
Yeah, but just okay is kind of the point, because Marvel movies have kind of a tail to them.
Mm-hmm.
The Friday to Saturday drop for Suicide Squad was 40%.
Which is, yeah, I think the comparison I saw was that, for comparison, Ghostbusters, who some movie analysts wanted to call, like, oh my god, what a huge drop for them, was 4.3%.
Yeah.
Like, astronomically. Like, yeah, that's a pretty brutal drop.
Yeah, the impression that I'm getting is that with both Batman vs. Superman and Suicide Squad, the diehards saw it. A lot of them went like, okay, we need to warn people not to see this movie, and word of mouth causes them to drop like a rock in the weekend sales and beyond.
Mm-hmm. But the diehards will keep going to see it, so they'll still keep making that initial burst of money.
Yeah, and their latest strategy is Well, for Batman vs. Superman, they released an R-rated director's cut on video on demand and stuff, and I would not be surprised if they did the same thing for Suicide Squad.
Do you think they'll start adding in the, like, I understand there were some scrapped plans to involve rape at various points in that game's, in that, not game, that movie's story. It's like, well, R-rated edit, let's add all that back in.
There's cut scenes of Jared Leto beating the shit out of Harley and stuff like that, and I'd rather not see those, even though the reason that they were cut in the first place was to make the Harley-Joker relationship romantic, which, no, it's not romantic at all. It's an abusive relationship, even with that him visually beating the shit out of her.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I've always been on the Marvel side of the DC-Marvel divide, and as much as I'm on anyone's side anymore, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, I'm not fucking going to bat for Marvel, but it's like, you know, Marvel does some cool stuff sometimes, and DC does some fucking gross shit that makes me embarrassed to be, you know, in the same culture as them sometimes, so.
Yeah. The frustrating part of Suicide Squad, really, the most frustrating part, aside from how it was completely, tonally dissonant because it was edited by two or three different teams and then smushed together, was the plot itself actually has potential. Like, this idea of this government woman basically seeing Superman do his thing and be like, hey, if the wrong Superman ends up being born, he could pretty much waltz right into the White House and straight up murder the president. And so basically, this woman, Amanda Waller, who is played by Viola Davis, and she's kind of amazing as this person who even the villains and heroes alike kind of quake beneath her steadfast resolve and ability to just do things with the power she wields. She ends up basically building this task squad in order to, as a preventative measure. The thing is, the very first person she recruits for this is this person named Enchantress, who is basically this ancient Mayan god who got released accidentally by this researcher. And the only thing that's basically keeping this god in check is Amanda Waller kind of found her totem, which acts as her heart. And if she ever steps out of line, she just basically opens the heart briefcase and starts stabbing it. And basically the very first time that they hear about trouble being brewed somewhere, she's like, okay, we're going to release Enchantress. And then that turns out to be a really, really bad idea, because Enchantress ends up taking control of a major city, and basically they have to send in the squad that they created to fight against this sort of stuff, basically turn it against each other. And it's this interesting idea. It could be this parallel for the bad things that happen when we decide to create massive weapons in order to force other people into peace. That stuff gets turned against us, and it becomes the reason why we sometimes wage wars or get into conflicts in the first place.
And I mean, as I feel like is very often the case with, like, comic book movies that mess things up, the best parts are the parts that are in the comic, right? The Suicide Squad in comics is a fucking killer idea. Suicide Squad was born out of them saying, like, what if we took villains that we don't use very much and don't care very much about and put them in a comic where, like, it's called the Suicide Squad. I don't know how. Okay, I'm not going to ask you to spoil the movie too much, I guess, for some reason. I don't think anyone actually cares, but I'm going to do it anyway. But, like, in the Suicide Squad comics, like, that name isn't just for show. The characters die all the goddamn time. And that's part of what makes it interesting, is that it's like, no, these are characters that are not, like, super important, and we can afford to just have them get killed. And Amanda Waller is amazing in that, because, like, yeah, like, I think, like, the first Suicide Squad mission in the comics, I don't totally remember, but there's some, like, some villain who was in other comics. He was a villain from somebody else's comics, and he was doing the mission, and it was going poorly, and he said, screw this, and Amanda Waller pushed a button, and his head exploded.
They do have that in this. Like, all of them are fitted with small, pin-sized explosives that she can press a button, and they're gone. That happens once. There's someone else who sacrifices themselves for the good of humanity, but there are two deaths overall. And both of them are the minority characters, and one of them has, like, maybe 5 or 10 minutes of total screen time, One of which he uses to deck this random military woman in the face and go, she had a mouth, and the audience in my screening kind of erupted in laughter, which, It's, you can see different kernels of ideas that are right. I'm kind of an odd duck out in people who dislike this movie, and I think that the idea that they had for Joker as a character is interesting. Like, having him as this gang leader, more or less, that basically peacocks himself using Joker makeup and just being unpredictable. That is something of an idea that is a bit different than the way Joker usually is just trying to do typical Doomsday villain stuff. But they don't really do anything with it, and you can tell that everyone involved in the movie really didn't like Jared Leto, because he's in it for like 7 to 10 minutes of the movie, and it's clear that giant chunks of what he did are cut out entirely.
Yeah. I mean, like, it's a shame, like, the comic Suicide Squad became popular because it had this reputation of no one is safe, right? Mm-hmm. It had this reputation of, like, no, you could open up, like, you could be like, oh, okay, these are the characters that are rocks and will never die because they're too central to the plot, and you open it up and they're just fucking dead. And eventually that stopped being the case, because any comic thing that goes on long enough will get too franchised, right?
Yeah.
But that was originally what made that comic popular. And, yeah, I don't know. I feel like, I mean, they should have killed Will Smith, right? Or something. Just, like, have some moment that calls back to that thing that made Suicide Squad interesting in the first place.
Yeah, basically. I guess there's not... Talking about the entire movie would take way too long, so I'll basically just sum it up by saying, what's the best way to describe it?
Poop from a butt.
Yeah, that, but also, I think that they had a really missed opportunity with Harley Quinn, since she's basically her and Deadshot are as close to protagonists as you get in this movie. And they just completely... She has amazing moments, and then they continue sabotaging them by having the different male characters call pretty much her and all the other women on the team crazy bitches, and basically turning her entire reason for joining the Joker into somewhat seduced, but also tied up by Joker and electroshocked until she was in love with him. And that's totally against a character who's one of her greatest strengths is she's always been someone who makes choices to go into crime and stuff like that on her own volition.
Yeah. So, I don't know. I'm going to give you three choices here, right, of what else I have been playing that we can talk about.
Okay.
I have finished Professor Layton and the Diabolical Box. I have been playing some Pokemon Diamond and Yellow after our conversation about Pokemon last week. and I have been poking at today's release of the Demon Hunter in World of Warcraft Legion. The Legion itself is not properly out, but they have early released the Demon Hunter for people to check out. Choose wisely.
I guess it has to do with how much you would want to talk about Legion. Otherwise, I'd probably go Layton.
I can hold off on Legion until there's more to talk about, because, you know, the proper expansion will come out eventually. So, Layton. One of the things... Okay, so... How spoilery should I get? This game is pretty old at this point, but I understand you haven't finished it, and I'm sure there are some of our listeners who might be curious about these games. I don't know, how spoilery should I get? Low, medium, high.
I guess medium spoiler would be okay. I basically got to the... I stopped around the point where I figured out the... Well, kind of a lame disguise from the recurring villain in the series, but...
I know, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah,
okay.
That's where I stopped. Somewhere
around
there.
That's fair. That was not a great moment. So, the first game is stronger than this one. Absolutely. This is the second game in the series, and I'm going to move on to Unwound Future, which I hear is very good. But one of the things that's interesting and doesn't get revealed until pretty late in the game that I will be vague about is in the first Layton game, it was revealed that there was a reason that there were so many puzzles, right?
Yeah.
There was a story reason for it that was genuinely, like, the story of Professor Layton and the Curious Village actually turns out to be, like, really sweet and touching. A really genuinely nice story, which really caught me off guard. And Diabolical Box is going for the same thing and doesn't, in my opinion, totally nail it. Partially because I came back to the game after taking a long time away, but I was surprised at how quickly the story wrapped up. But there is, once again, a justification for why you're like everyone you meet has a puzzle for you to solve, right?
Mm-hmm.
But not for the entire game. Only for when you get to the big city, full sense. Before that, everyone you meet has a puzzle for you to solve, and there's not really any explanation for that. And to a certain extent, then it's just like, well, this is the world of Professor Layton. Everyone loves puzzles all the time, and they always have a puzzle for you, right?
Yeah.
But then in Curious Village and Diabolical Box, they have explicitly gone out of the way to establish why you're being given puzzles in certain areas. So then that doesn't really make sense. That, like, either this is how the world is or this is not how the world is, right? Is this remarkable or not?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I think the puzzles in the Layton games are hit and miss because there are just so goddamn many of them. In this one, there are over 200. I don't remember how many there are in Curious Village, but there's a ton of puzzles.
Yeah, and that's simple.
Go ahead.
Oh, at some point they were also, I don't think the service is still alive anymore, but they were adding new puzzles every week.
Yeah. I don't know, I'm not interested in the puzzles for the sake of the puzzles, generally, right?
Yeah.
I'm there for the art, the atmosphere, the story, and the characters. And sometimes the puzzles are pretty fun. Sometimes they're not so much, and I will look up an answer, because I'm like, no, this, like, it's not just that I'm not getting this type of puzzle I just don't enjoy. Like, these ones where it's like, oh, like, this guy's tied up, but this rope is looping all over the place like crazy. Can you figure out where the rope loops over itself? It's like, I'm not staring at this tangle of ropes for 5 minutes. That's not what we're doing. Here's the answer, fuck off. But it is interesting how the puzzles reinforce the kind of guy that Layton is, right?
Yeah.
Because, like, I mean, there is a point in this game where you are challenged to a duel, like, with swords. And it's not like someone slaps you with a glove. It's like someone grabs a sword and is like, you've got 5 seconds to grab a sword before I run you through. And first off, finding a sword is a riddle that you have to solve, which is great. And then when there's the cutscene of you sword fighting with this guy, it's just sort of Leighton fending off his strikes repeatedly and then going like, well, hold on now, I think we're being a bit rash. And it's just... they don't make protagonists like that guy in games very often. He is, like... he assumes the best about everyone he meets. He is an intellectual. He enjoys a challenge. And it's just really, like, even if all the puzzles in that game were bad, I would play that game just to be refreshed by the kind of character they think is cool.
Yeah, it's like this, it's like if James Bond was the most polite person ever, and also wasn't a bit, also liked to get out of situations through cognitive skill rather than killing everyone.
It's like if Indiana Jones was just a professor, and he still went on these adventures, but he wasn't whipping and shooting people, he was just like, oh, hang on, I know about this. I was like, this is great. So I don't know. It's actually made me kind of wary about Unwound Future, because one of the things I know about Unwound Future is that it involves time travel. Is that it involves, at one point, Professor Leighton building a machine gun out of a slot machine, which sounds hilarious, but also, like, actually, why would he do that? Like, he got in a duel with a dude and was just trying to talk to him. Like, that's... it seems strange for who this guy is. And... I am wondering a couple of things. Specifically for Unwound Future, I'm wondering if the reason people like it is because it takes a tonal shift that I am going to disapprove of. And I wonder what this means for the new Leighton that they are going to be releasing soon with Professor Layton's daughter.
Yeah, I think I know slightly more about Unwound Future than you do, in sort of funny regard. But yeah, from my understanding, it is something... it is supposed to be something of a darker tale that sort of throws some of your expectations of how the series goes and what kind of characters each person is on its head.
And if they earn it, that's fine. I don't know. There's something, like... Curious Village ended up being, like... when I say, like, adorable, like... the art looks very Studio Ghibli, and it turned out that that game was just like, oh no, this is just like, it's interactive and it takes kind of too long because of all these puzzles, but it just feels like a Ghibli movie. The plot of that feels very much like the kind of thing they would make, where it's a world that's fantastic and wondrous and is about children and is about innocence and is about growing up, and it was just... it was just a phenomenal surprise when I finished that game and found out what had been going on in that game.
Yeah, it's a really nice reveal.
And I don't want the dark entry in the series where it turns out Leighton's, you know, I don't know, like a man with a dark past and he used to be a murderer. I don't let him drink tea and talk to people about their problems. Let him solve matchstick puzzles. Don't make me solve the matchstick puzzles. I have had my fill of matchstick puzzles.
Yeah, it's...
but... I don't know.
It's killing me not to mention the one thing I know about Unwound Future that I don't know is an actual...
I can mention one thing I know. In the future, evil Leighton is a dictator? Or something like that? The villain of the game is Leighton from the dark future? I'm misunderstanding something.
I'm not super clear on it either, but he is definitely something of an antagonist in Unwound Future. At least something like that. But since it's time travel, it's hard to tell what exactly happened to him in that regard.
And I'm sure, like, since these games are, like, original DS games, I'm sure the audience of ours who has played these is just like, these games came out years ago, what is wrong with you people? So I'll shut up about it for now.
They really need to make HD remakes because, man, that video quality is just so terrible.
It's rough.
Yeah, and it's such a beautiful art style and animation. It deserves better.
It does. I would be delighted by an HD, you know, like HD trilogy thing or something. Like they did for Ace Attorney. But
Yeah.
I am looking forward to digging into Unwound Future.
All right.
And until I do so, I will stop telling an audience who probably knows way better than I what Layton is actually about. I guess let's close with our thoughts on the Overwatch World Cup.
Okay. I'll go ahead and explain a bit about that then. Feel free to jump in and correct me if I'm skipping anything.
Okay.
Basically, Overwatch announced its first real... Blizzard announced its first real sort of Overwatch competition, and the idea is that sometime this week... Actually, it might start around... The voting might start around the 11th, I believe, so sometime this week. We're basically given... The community is given a choice of a number of players they can vote for, which includes people that are really highly ranked in competitive play, and various people in the community, maybe a few professional esports players, and basically you vote for your region's team makeup, and from there... These different countries will compete to go to BlizzCon to have a 16 per... And the top 16 teams get to go to BlizzCon to duke it out in front of a live audience.
And here is the part where we get a little preachy, right?
Yeah.
Because there are two important caveats to this. One is that there are some countries that are... Like, there's going to be this tournament to decide who gets to go. Some countries are getting invited regardless of how well they do.
Yeah.
And the other part is the part where they're not paying people. They're getting, you know, transportation and hotel stays and, of course, tickets to BlizzCon for their, I'm not going to say for free, for their efforts, because they are earning them. There is no prize pool for this tournament. They are not being paid to participate.
Yeah, I don't even know if... Their travel and lodging is entirely paid for either. All they say is a free trip, and that could mean another things, a number of things.
That's a good point. That's a good point.
There's no point where they specify all expenses paid or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it's in a field where pretty much every other competitive sport in this competitive esport has tournaments that go for money and that the players are compensated for. And even within Blizzard itself, I'm pretty sure that they pay the Hearthstone champions and the StarCraft champions and all that stuff.
As we speak, in Seattle, Washington, 16 teams are fighting at the International Six for $20,188,030 and counting.
Yeah, and...
That your World Cup for your game that you have sold 15 million copies of, plus extra purchases across three platforms on your own private system called Battle.net, with the support of Activision, one of the biggest gaming publishers, and you can't afford to pay these people? I'm getting some serious, like, it's an honor to participate shit going on. I'm getting some, like, be grateful for the opportunity shit. I'm thinking about all the people in our like, aspirational line of work, right? Like, not our line of work, but what we hope to become, who are like, oh, sure, you can write for us, and, you know, we're not paying you, but be grateful for the publicity, and maybe you'll get a real job off of it, right?
Yeah, the exposure.
And that's what this is. This is play for the exposure. And I, like, for the people who are, like, Twitch streamers or just people who happen to be highly ranked in matchmaking, like, this is a great opportunity for them to get scouted by a pro team and make it for real. That doesn't change the fact that they should be paid for their time. They shouldn't be heading out there, taking time off of work, taking time away from their families to go play on a stage so that Blizzard can sell tickets to this tournament and they don't see a dime.
Yeah, and copies of Overwatch, because whenever any of these sorts of tournaments happen, it's inevitable that more people will end up buying it.
Yeah, it's kind of infuriating. It makes me kind of angry. It's not just that this is like, oh, well, that's a shitty thing. It's like, no, this is kind of abusive.
Yeah.
And I don't know. It's really strange to me. Like, Blizzard holds, you know, has held StarCraft Grand Finals, World, you know, Championships for a while. They've started doing Hearthstone. They know what esports is and is about. They have the infrastructure, they have the money, they have the reputation. I don't understand how they're failing to pay these people for their time. And maybe this is okay, maybe it's going to turn out there's some I pulled up the page and I was going to say, like, maybe they've just failed to mention it, but, like, no, they spell out in no uncertain terms, like, what these people are getting. An appearance bonus, I don't know, like, that's probably some level of money. That's a good point. I had overlooked that. They're getting an appearance bonus and a free trip to BlizzCon. There is no prize pool for the tournament. Maybe they're getting paid just to show up. Maybe this is, like, if you make it here, who cares about the prize pool because you're all getting $10,000. I fucking doubt it.
Yeah, and also, I guess you're a lot more generous in the appearance bonus than I was, because what I thought that was is it's something on their account or their characters that looks a bit different than other people.
Oh, boy. really, you think?
That's how I read it.
Man, I don't think they can do that. I think they will get a cash bonus for appearing. If they give them icons for their accounts, like, fucking get out the picket signs and torches. Like, Jesus Christ.
Yeah, I'm kind of amazed at that. Everyone seems to be... Well, I haven't heard a lot of people get really upset about the way that they're organizing their first cup.
I mean, this is esports, right? Like, we were talking the other day about the possibility of me applying to an opening in games journalism, right?
Yeah.
And one of the things you talked about is that I am slightly an added value because I kind of understand esports. I'm not, like, I can't be the host of Esports Today. I don't know the scene crazy well, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I know StarCraft 2 okay. I know Dota really well. I kind of understand some of these other ones. And that's really rare in games media.
Yeah.
People don't tend to know this stuff. And so, like, nobody's raising a stink, I think, because the people who would know are sort of the, like, just the ground floor community people, and they don't, like, they don't have a place to put their voice out there, and they're also kind of the targets of this, right? If you're a guy who spends a lot of time on r/Overwatch and has been grinding to get into the top 500 in your area in you know, ranked, this is an opportunity for you. And you're probably not going to get there, but, like, you know, some of them will. Some of these people are going to get chosen to go to this, and they're not going to be the ones saying this opportunity is not good enough. They see the opportunity and they want it. They're not going to be the ones standing on the sidelines going, wait, this is kind of bullshit. I am lucky enough to be super interested in esports and completely talentless and never going to make it that far, so I can throw shade.
Yeah, it's one of the situations where I haven't heard many competitive teams, like the established ones, always end up supporting multiple games over time. Mm-hmm. I haven't heard any of them really mention Overwatch that much, and I wonder if that World Cup stuff that Overwatch is doing is going to continue that trend. Like, if they're seeing this and going, oh, hey, there's no money in this, why bother?
I mean, so as far as Overwatch Pro teams, I know that TSM used to have a team, Team Solo Mid, who was a big force in League of Legends, and also Counter-Strike. And they have now they've moved to Complexity. So Complexity has an Overwatch team. I think LGD has a Counter-Strike team. Fnatic has an Overstrike? Is that what I said? Overwatch team. Like, this community is starting to be built. And I think they're pretty small yet for a lot of reasons. One, the tournament structure has not really been organized. There hasn't been that big, like, banner tournament like League of Legends' Worlds or Dota 2's International or StarCraft 2's World Championships to really put them on the map and make people take notice. But it feels like a matter of whiff, of when, not if. I think it's gonna happen. It's gonna get there. And I have to hope that the community shakes out before then, that Blizzard chooses to support them in a way that is not exploitative, as this appears to be, or that the community says, go fuck yourselves, and handles it themselves. Because we have examples of competitive scenes thriving in spite of their creators, right?
Mm-hmm.
Counter-Strike Go is not... Valve doesn't treat them that well, frankly. They run in spite of Valve.
Basically, yeah.
Team Fortress 2 had a competitive scene for a long time, in spite of them being repeatedly undermined by Valve. And in that case, eventually they gave up. Eventually they said, fuck it, no more competitive Team Fortress 2. You guys are working too hard to screw us over. And then a couple of years passed, and then Valve added a competitive mode to TF2. So basically, what the fuck? But really, your odds of making it are so much better if your developer is on your side, and I really hope Blizzard gets their shit together.
For sure.
And a good first step would be paying these people for their time.
Absolutely.
And I think that'll do it for this episode of Scanline Status. Thanks, everybody, for joining us. It's feel like that was a pretty decent episode. You can find us at scanlinemedia.com, where we have articles and editorials and video features all about gaming and other geek interests, if I'm allowed to use that phrase. If you want to give us a little backing to help us cover more things, you can go to patreon.com/scanlinemedia. Any contributions you give us will go towards getting us more hardware or software for the site. None of it goes into people's pockets. And all of our content is free and will continue to stay free for the foreseeable future. We have no plans to change that. Your backing is just a nice thing you can do for us. But if you're short on money, or you're just like, I don't want to pay for this, that's cool. You know what you could do for free that would help us out? We're on iTunes. You could give us a rating or review there, and that will help draw more people to us. They'll see the site, they'll see the podcast, and they'll encourage us to go further with our content. And that would be really great. So where Scanline presents for this feed on there. And I'm at 6264 on Twitter if you want to send me any thoughts. Always open for that. Thanks so much for listening.
Mm-hmm.
We'll see you next time.
And I'm at JBU3. And see you later.